The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And I want to start with a question that might sound kind of simple. Mm-hmm. Why generally do we not build statues of people who are still alive? Now, I know sometimes we do. You got the bronze fauns.
Yeah.
And Henry Winkler is still out there.
I believe in New Zealand, there is a statue of Richard O'Brien as Riff Raff from the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
And of course, there's the statue of RoboCop, which...
I don't know if I knew about this one.
No, wait, maybe that doesn't exist yet. Maybe that's only... People want there to be a statue of RoboCop in Detroit. Does it exist? I'm not sure if that's been realized.
Huh.
In any case, RoboCop lives on in all our hearts forever, so there could never be a statue of him.
But even these are fictional characters. Even the Richard O'Brien one is a picture of Richard O'Brien as a fictional character.
Yeah, there are a few cases where people build statues of people who are still alive. It doesn't happen that often, and it always strikes me as really just not smart and distasteful. I don't know if you get the same feeling. Like, if you just see a statue of a living person, it's like, what? Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, because there are a few different factors that come into play. First of all, if I'm asking someone or commissioning a statue of myself, there's some, you know, you're just asking for charges of narcissism and, you know, you think you're a golden god or something because you're having this large golden version of you, you know, erected in town.
No, and, I just think I'm a marble god.
Or then the other side too is we've seen enough examples of this throughout history, particularly in the fall of the Soviet Union, to know that if there is a statue of you, then that is something that someone can deface or knock down. It's you're just asking for it.
Yeah, I would say one large exception to what I'm talking about is in like dictatorships, where there will be statues of a living leader.
Yeah, but I mean, these are examples though where they should feel bad, but they are removed from the guilt of feeling bad because of the depravity of the system.
Yeah, but so then you agree with my intuition there? Is that the case? You just think like when you see a statue of a person who's still alive, it's like, what? Why would you do that?
Yeah, okay, because the other thing too is maybe you're going to have a perfect likeness of that individual, but it also may come off as a little creepy because you're going to see it like right next to the person, or it's easier to compare the flesh to the statue and realize the statue is inaccurate.
Yeah. So what does the answer there tell us about what purpose statues serve? I don't know. Maybe we can come back to that. I got another weird question. Why are statues considered inherently positive or honorific? Another way of asking this is, why do we generally only create statues of people we like? How come we don't generally create statues of people who we think were evil and destructive or shifty or, you know, just not honorable people? And it's one of those things that's so ingrained that it just seems obvious, like, well, duh, you know, you wouldn't put up a statue to honor a bad person. But why do you assume a statue carries honor with it? You don't assume that about other forms of media. You could make a movie about a bad person and people wouldn't assume that it was honoring that person. You could write a book about a bad person and people wouldn't assume that the book was honoring that person. But if you were to build a statue of that person, people would say, well, why do you like this guy so much?
Well, I think a lot of this, I think we can answer a couple of questions here by dealing with the idea of what happens when you just erect a tombstone for someone. You are creating something that is not going to fade. I mean, yes, it's going to fade, but within the context of a human lifetime, it seems fixed. It seems, unmovable and incorruptible. And so to create a statue of an individual is to create an immortal version of them.
Impose that person's legacy on physical space.
Right. Either after their death, or, you know, in the case of, say, a mythological figure or a figure of such deep history that they're, you know, far removed, like you don't have photos of them, you just have tales of them, it makes them more real.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I just wonder why. I mean, it might be totally an accident of history. Maybe it's just a coincidence that, well, okay, so people used to make statues of leaders who were to be honored and statues of kings and all that, and we just came to associate statuary with honor and honorific feelings.
Well, now I have to say there are, of course, the idea of using horrifying but protective entities, say in a tomb or a temple.
Right.
You could have, essentially, it's a monster. It's something horrifying, but it's there to ward off evil spirits.
Well, right. And that comes into the religious function of statuary. So you've got statues that I was going to say that you can imagine religious scenarios where people have statues of demons and other unwelcome supernatural entities, either for instructive purposes or for protective purposes, you know, apotropaic magic.
Yeah.
Or just to be scary. So you can see religious reasons why people put up statues of things judged to be evil.
But could you imagine a scenario where someone might say, look, we're not putting up a statue of Richard Nixon, but we'll put up multiple Richard Nixon statues to protect this sacred ground? You know, like purely protective evils, if you will.
Right. You what you bring up yet again is this assumption. If I made a statue of Richard Nixon, people would assume I liked him. People would assume I thought he was a good guy.
Right.
Would not be the case if I wrote a book about him or made a movie about him. I mean, depending on what the contents were.
Right. And again, this is assuming it's just a statue of him and he's not being, say, crushed under the foot of a Hindu deity or something like that.
Exactly right. That's another great image.
Because I think what we're talking about here in most of these examples, it's not a statue of an individual doing something as much as it's a statue of the individual, just their identity, their presence, their existence.
Yeah, and so maybe for some inherent reasons we haven't figured out, or maybe for reasons of historical accident or whatever, statuary, I think, does have a religious connotation.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's no surprise that some of the grandest statues in the world, of course, are religious.
Yeah, if you look at a list of the largest statues currently in the world, most of them are going to be religious in scope. You'll find a few historic individuals in there, but really, like the top 10 list are mostly Buddhas. And today, we're going to be talking about one of the grandest Buddhas. Statues that you'll find out there, and that is the Lusan Giant Buddha, or the Grand Buddha, located in southern Sichuan province in southwest China.
So I thought it was interesting that you wanted to do this episode, Robert. What was it that drew you to the Lusan Buddha?
Well, I'd seen images of it before, and weirdly enough, to just throw in an unintended plug for another podcast. But I was in the car and was listening to the Wow in the World podcast, which is an NPR science education podcast for children.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a kid throw in a quick fact about something that they learned on a trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a kid on the street kind of situation. And the kid mentioned the Lashan giant Buddha,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of reminded me of its existence and one of the cool facts about it that we'll get to in a bit. And then I started looking into it a little more and said, hey, well, there's a whole episode here. We should talk about the Lashan giant Buddha.
So if you are at a computer right now,
mm-hmm.
and you are listening to this episode where you can Google something, you should probably go ahead and Google a picture of it, right?
Yes.
To try to have this in your mind. If you've never seen it before, if you can't do that, that's okay. We'll try to describe it for you.
Yeah, we'll definitely have some images of it on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But it looks like a giant Buddha has carved out a niche in a mountain and is seated there. Within the mountain. Like, so basically the Buddha is a mountain. The mountain is the Buddha to steal the common slogan from the region.
And the Buddha is literally made out of the mountain.
Yes. Carved out of the side of the mountain. But in a way that, you know, I think for a lot of Western audiences, when you think of something carved out of a mountain, you think of our more local examples. You think of Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you think of Stone Mountain here in Georgia, or you think of Crazy Horse, right?
Right.
But this one feels a lot different from any of those examples because mm-hmm. it almost feels like there was a Buddha in the mountain and they just carved it out. Like it was waiting there for all of this, the sculpture work to free it.
Absolutely. Those other things you mentioned, like Mount Rushmore, feel very much imposed on the landscape. Mm-hmm. They're a thing laid over the landscape. And I feel like the Buddha in Lashan is either it's like it emerged from the landscape or is being absorbed by the landscape.
It almost feels like you found it, like it's like it's a fossil Buddha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great metaphor, dude. It is very much like that. One thing we should say though is, okay, so you imagine something that's carved out of a mountain or might be like a fossil. You're probably not thinking very big. This thing is big. It's huge.
Yeah, it is 71 meters or 233 feet tall. And it's in a seated position. It's not mm-hmm. standing. I don't think I ran across any estimates on how tall this Buddha would be if it were standing full height somehow.
I should have done the math on that.
Yeah.
Missed opportunity.
If the Ghostbusters were to, charge it with enough ectoplasm and make it walk around.
Right.
Yeah. But that's somebody else's research project. We'll leave them to it. Now, the other remarkable thing about it is that this is a very old statue.
Uh-huh.
This was a Tang Dynasty construction, so that's 1,200 years ago, and it is the largest stone Buddha in the world, and currently it's the 18th tallest statue in the world. Number one, by the way, is China's Spring Temple Buddha at a towering 128 meters or 420 feet.
Now, how many of those top 20 or so are Richard Nixon's?
None of them, actually. But several of them are Buddhas or some are Bodhisattvas. And I think in one particular note is two famed Chinese emperors. But also the vast majority of them are from recent times.
Mm-hmm.
Of the taller statues in the world, all of them were completed in the 20th or 21st century. The Grand Buddha, however, again, was finished in 803 CE.
And this thing looks old. As we said, it's like a fossil. So it's a cliff coming straight out of the river, just shooting straight up out of the Dadu River. And away from it's like a red stone cliff. You can see this orange tinge in the white. And then back away from the cliff, there is this recession.
Mm-hmm.
And within the recession is, I don't know, you don't really see a throne or anything. It might be hidden back there behind all of the growth that's come out over the years. But you do see the figure of the Buddha seated with his knees spread apart, his back very straight, and his hands resting on his knees. And the entire statue, like we said, is carved into the side of the mountain, receding away from the cliff face. And so the Buddha is looking out over the river, as if he's sort of like lording over the waters, mm-hmm. and the waters are rushing by just underneath his feet. How would you describe his face, Robert? I would say it's very calm.
It's calm, serene, almost disinterested. In a way that he does remind me of a YMCA lifeguard. Yeah. Like he's watching over the waters, and I'm not sure how interested he is in me not drowning.
Yeah, this is not one of the laughing Buddhas.
No, and we'll get into exactly what kind of Buddha he is in a minute. But certainly the scale of this thing is amazing from the photos. I have not been to see this in person, and I would love to hear from any of our listeners out there who have, because it is a huge tourist attraction. People traveling to the area, you know, go out of their way to see this and the surrounding historic temple and even, you know, natural attractions in the area. But you look at this and you just see how small the individuals are in comparison to the feet, to the toes
right.
of this statue.
Right. There are people standing on the base where the Buddha's feet are, and they're not even as tall as the Buddha's sandal.
Right. You know, I think for Western audiences, especially for American audiences, like when we think of a giant statue, of course, we think of the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. But then how big would the Statue of Liberty be compared to the Lhasan Buddha?
Well, so there are multiple ways you can measure the Statue of Liberty. Now, if you measure the full thing, like with the base up to the top of the torch, it's bigger than the Lhasan Buddha. But if you just look at the copper part of the statue, from her heel to the top of her head, Lady Liberty is just over 111 feet. So if she put her arm down, you could stand one Lady Liberty on the shoulders of another one and still not be as tall as the Lhasan Buddha.
Wow. Now, it's always difficult to gauge these things, though, just as a viewer, because you see Lady Liberty up there, you know, no, you don't see any humans really in reference to it, unless
right.
you're, you know, dealing with the Ghostbusters in Ghostbusters 2. Otherwise, it's easy to lose scope of what its scale is. Whereas with the Lhasan Buddha, you tend to see individuals at its base, so you have kind of a grounding in how big it appears to be.
So this is supposed to be a Buddha, Robert. Tell me about the Buddha.
All right. Well, yeah, we should break down exactly what a Buddha is. So,
well, wait, I thought you should say something like, I can't tell you about the Buddha.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some you know, if someone goes to tell you about the Buddha, don't let them tell you about the Buddha. Sort of if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha kind of a thing. But there are different Buddhas, and that's an important thing to note. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to not be aware of if you're just kind of, you see statues and you just assume that these are all statues of the same individual, historic or mythical, and it's just different artistic takes.
Right.
And there are a number of different artistic takes on these Buddhas. But for starters, you have what's known as the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who lived in the 5th century BCE. Exact century kind of varies depending on who's telling. But this would have been ancient India. And the story is that he was a prince, you know, lived a life of luxury. And then he began to behold the sorrow of the world, the suffering in the world, and he abandoned his riches. He became a monk in order to seek enlightenment, and his teachings then spread throughout most of Asia in the centuries to follow. Now, interestingly enough, it actually declined in India itself during the Middle Ages with the rise of Islam, but it flourished elsewhere, including in China. Where it made its way in there around 100 BCE and subsequently became an integral part of Chinese culture. And Buddhism today remains the fourth largest religion in the world.
Now, I think I'm to understand that throughout history at different times, the adoption of Buddhism in China has been a controversial thing, right? Like there were times when Chinese ruling dynasties were trying to enforce other beliefs, like they might say that people need to be Taoist or people need to be Confucian, right?
Yes, certainly, because when you look at the history of China, of course, you have essentially three key worldviews that are, you know, getting into the mix there. You have Buddhism, you have Taoism, and you have Confucianism. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a continual, you know, cocktail. To what degree are these meshed together? In an individual time and an individual region. Now, to come back to the Lhasan Buddha, what makes this interesting is that the first Chinese Buddhist temple was built in Sichuan province on the summits of Mount Emi. And this is the very area, the very region in which the Grand Buddha was carved.
Now, maybe we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we can get a little bit into the history of how this Grand Buddha was constructed more than 1,200 years ago.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So there's an origin story here, as there always is.
Yeah, and maybe we should say, as many origins, if you go back far enough, there's a flood in the story somewhere, right?
Yes.
Except in this case, it's more of a pattern of flooding, right? And this is a historical fact that's not just part of the mythology. The central and southwest region of China is prone to lots of flooding, right?
Yeah. I mean, we ended up discussing some of this in our Great Flood episode. We talked about Chinese, the Chinese variant of the Great Flood myth. and the importance of water management and manipulation in Chinese history.
Yeah, so it's like it's a humid, I think, subtropical climate, but they'll have monsoon seasons, where the rains come in, and there will be heavy rains that cause flooding in these plains areas. Refresh me a little bit on the Chinese flood myth, Robert.
Oh, well, you're talking about the story of Yu the Great, yeah, where essentially you just have this flood that occurs, and who is going to who's going to deal with it? How are we going to solve this problem? Mm-hmm. Instead of the creation of an ark or, you know, a great boat, you have Yu the Great, who uses the knowledge of canal systems and drainage systems as a way to manage the flooding.
Oh, that's a much better solution than a boat, right?
Yeah,
like works for more than one group of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably something culturally telling about that as well. Like it's a particularly Chinese take on the problem, but also ties in with very, you know, real world issues of the day, which would have been seasonal flooding.
Yeah, so there is seasonal flooding in this area, that sometimes the rivers will swell, and this can be a danger to the people who work in or around the river. And this ties into where the Buddha came from.
That's right. So the origin story, the basic version, goes as follows. You have a Buddhist monk named Haitong, and he conceives this project around 713 CE. So his idea is, look, we have really turbulent waters out here on the Dadu River. It's really rough on boatmen, navigation. People are drowning. It's influenced by these seasonal floods. If we're to build a Buddha here, then that would bring like fortune to the area. Like that would bring a calming influence on these turbulent waters, where you ultimately have the confluence of three different rivers: the Mingjiang, the Dadu, and the Qingyi rivers.
Yeah, and in reading about this, I came across what appears to be some kind of popular legend about Haitong's quest to get the Buddha built. This was good, so I had to repeat it, but I want to stress this is the best I can synthesize from scattered and discrepant telling. So this is probably legendary, might not even be an old legend. Who knows if this was created recently? But here's what people are saying. So Haitong in this story knew that it would cost a lot of money to get the Buddha built, and he traveled far and wide soliciting alms for the construction. And slowly over time, he built up a fund. He managed to get together enough money for the stoneworks and the carving. But at some point in the project, Haitong was called to an audience with a corrupt government official, with a Richard Nixon, who told him, "Haitong, it's time to hand over the funds." And Haitong said, "I'd rather give up my eyes than give up the great Buddha." And when the corrupt official pressed him to give him the money, Haitong gouged out his own eyes, or one of his own eyes, and threw them at the official's feet. And supposedly this got the guy to leave him alone. Now, I again, with my warning, I've seen various versions of this story told and retold across sources, but I can't locate an authoritative original source from this. So I'm going to file this under probably legendary. Whether it's an old legend or a recent creation is unclear.
And I think that even if it is a recent addition to the legend, this will be something that ties in to our further discussions of the Buddha here in a bit.
Okay.
Now, earlier I talked about, well, we mentioned Siddhartha Gautama as the historic Buddha, and I alluded to the existence of other Buddhas that are important as well. So let's go ahead and get that out of the way. This is not a statue. The grand Buddha here is not a statue of Gautama.
So it's not trying to be a depiction of that historical guy.
Correct. So while Gautama is the historic Buddha, Buddhism recognizes many different Buddhas. For instance, in Theravada Buddhism, there are 27 Buddhas who preceded Gautama. Then you also have other important Buddhas, like the Medicine Buddha is tremendously important. If you've ever been to the Met in New York, in their Asian section, they have an enormous mural on the wall, and it depicts the Medicine Buddha. And then we have the Buddha that is actually depicted here, and that is Maitreya, the, the Buddha of the future.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. This is a really exciting Buddha. And some of you might remember some mention of Maitreya from the self-embalming Buddhist monks episode we did a while back. And that has to do with a Japanese practice. But it also involved Maitreya. So according to some traditions, Maitreya is going to come to Earth 5.6 billion years in the future. And until then...
Whoa, 5.6 billion?
Yes.
Is there still going to be an Earth in 5.6 billion years?
There's going to be something that Maitreya can visit. So I don't know. You can go kind of sci-fi crazy with this. Like maybe we're all living on a spaceship, a colony ship at that point. But Maitreya will find us.
Oh, okay.
That's my read on it.
Well, he is the Buddha of the future.
Exactly. So until he's needed, he's going to reside in a heaven, sort of a Buddhist heaven that's set aside from our reality. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of think of him as a Buddha Messiah, I suppose, and that he'll eventually bring Dharma back to a far future world that has mostly forgotten it.
Hmm.
So it's pretty exciting. Maitreya factors into a number of different artistic depictions. So if you go to a museum of Buddhist art or Asian art, there's a very good chance you will encounter Maitreya at least a few times.
What is the most commonly depicted Buddha? Do you know?
You know, it's gonna depend. I think I have to admit that when I was younger, I definitely fell into the category of thinking there was just a Buddha, and you would see sometimes Buddha is you know, fat and happy, and sometimes Buddha is starved and kind of solemn looking.
Mm-hmm.
But there are going to be different emphasis in different cultures, and then sometimes things we might casually think of as being Buddhas are actually bodhisattvas, which is kind of, you know, a notch lower. Or and then sometimes they're depictions of important monk figures.
Hmm.
But I know that you do encounter Maitreya, the medicine Buddha, and the historic Buddha, Gautama, quite a bit. So the grand Buddha here, this depiction of Maitreya, it is eventually completed. 90 years after it started, by that point, Haitong has died.
Mm-hmm.
And the story about the blinding, even if that didn't happen as the story indicates, it does seem that there were points where funding stalled out, where work ceased, and thus this long process of actually finishing the statue.
But of course, now that it's finished, we really do have kind of would you call it a sort of wonder of the world on our hands?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind because we often think of the seven wonders of the world.
Right, of the ancient world.
Of the ancient world. And, yeah. Of course, they were based on knowledge of the ancient world by individuals at the time, which tended to exclude anything that was happening in Asia. It was confined to a different region of the world. And a number of those things aren't even around anymore. There are even questions about whether some of them existed to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I've long thought we should do an episode or a series of episodes on each of the seven wonders of the ancient world and discuss like what they were / are,
mm-hmm.
what happened to them, and why people were so invested in them at the time. But that's for another episode. Yeah. But if you were to actually take in the wonders of the world, and do a complete overview and take in all regions of the earth, I feel like the Lishan Buddha would have to be on there, because it's a tremendous work of sculpture, and the body actually contains a drainage system to prevent weathering to a certain extent. So there are spiral coils and cross drainage systems like built into its surface that help to drain water away from it. And again, this is because this is an area that is frequented by seasonal flooding, tremendous rainfall, and it's a very temperate climate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if Haitong's goal was to calm the angry river gods and put a Buddha in there to pacify the hateful waters of the river mm-hmm. in the rain season, did it work?
Well, that's one of the really fascinating aspects of this story, is that according to many, it did work. Now, how did it work? Well, that's where it gets interesting. If it actually worked in calming the waters beneath its gaze, the likely reason for this is probably because you had over the decades, you have all of this excavation, and this is dumping so much surplus rock into the river hollows below that it actually has an effect on the flow of the river. Like you're remaking the mountain. You're remaking the environment surrounding the mountain, and in doing so, you're remaking the river. You're sort of inadvertently altering the flow of the river.
Huh. Now, I have some skepticism there because the river's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, if you see pictures of it, it's a gigantic waterway. So I would think it would take a great amount of deposits to change the river fundamentally. I can believe more that it would change like local areas of the river.
Yeah. And I think that I think the individuals who are making that argument are definitely focusing like on the filling in of hollows within the river,
yeah,
and affecting the very localized nature of it. I think if you get into anything beyond that, then you're getting into kind of magical mythic thinking. You know, oh, we built a statue so big that the surplus rock, you know, changed the earth.
Right.
All right. So when we first started out this episode, we asked the question, why would you build a statue? And the best answer I think we could come up with is you want this idea or this person to last forever, to live forever.
Right.
And so in building the Grand Buddha, the idea is, yeah, this is going to be around for a long time. Maybe it's even going to be long enough that the actual Maitreya can visit it and say, hey, that's me up there. But
I don't think the statue is going to make it 5 billion years.
I don't think it is either, because that's the thing about any kind of stonework, any kind of sculpture, is that yes, they do tend to last longer than living human beings. But when you start having this thing live within geologic time, don't expect a whole lot, because
right,
you have all of these eroding effects in the natural world, and they're not going to leave your statue alone just because it's not technically a mountain anymore.
Right. I mean, there used to be continents in places where there now are not continents, and vice versa. The face of the earth is constantly changing. And so while a stone statue might last a very long time, probably much longer than many other creations of humankind, it's not going to last forever.
Right. You're going to have wind. You're going to have rain. You're going to have also an issue with sculptures. You're going to have plant life growing in it, around it.
Which I would now say is one of the coolest features of the Grand Buddha.
Yeah.
If you see pictures of it, it's not only receding into the mountain, so in this hollow in the cliff face, but it's also got all this green coming out around it. So it's being absorbed by the landscape in more ways than one. It's sinking into the mountain or emerging from a recess in the mountain, but it's also emerging from the biosphere almost, or sinking into the biosphere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it adds the natural wonder of it. But on at the same level, it's kind of like having a bunch of, say, English ivy grow up the side of your house. On one level, it looks really nice, but on the other, you have plants like growing on and into your stonework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another important factor here is we mentioned that a lot of people go to it. This is a popular tourist destination. I was reading in a Lonely Planet guide for China that if you're going to visit the Grand Buddha, it's best not to even try to go on a weekend or a holiday, because the stairs around it become so packed with tourists that you can't even move. It just comes to a standstill.
Now, of course, anytime you got lots of people visiting something, that's going to be a risk to the preservation of it. People touching things,
mm-hmm.
People, hopefully they're not going to be able to touch too much of it here because you can't get out there and climb on his nose. But yeah, I mean, somehow exposure to people, I think it's going to start wearing at you.
Yeah.
And
the human erosion takes place.
Another thing I just have to mention now that you talked about, tourists arriving, is I watched a homemade video on YouTube that I found of a family visiting the Buddha at a time when there was intense flooding in the river just under. So like the waters were rushing by and they were rising up to just below the platform where the Buddha's feet are.
Mm-hmm.
And this family paid somebody to get them out to the statue, even though it was dangerous weather and it was flooding. And there's this video on YouTube of them just walking around with almost nobody there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is apparently not the usual scene on a weekend at the Grand Buddha. Now, on top of natural erosion, human erosion, there's also the added threat of pollution, which we'll get into a little bit more in a bit. But yeah, you have with the rise and continued rise of industrialized human civilization,
mm-hmm.
You're going to have both natural and man-made features of the earth that are going to be affected by all the resulting pollution. Yeah, in particular, there's like a blackening that occurs on some of these statues. So you'll have your statue of a Buddha, and then over time, like there's like a blackening of the nose, as if as if the nose is rotting away or something. And at the very least, it's not maybe not the artist's intention for the sculpture.
I hate to see that happen to this great old work of art, but that's also kind of cool.
So I was reading about preservation for this Buddha and other like sacred sites, various sculptures in China. There was an article titled "Conservation of Ancient Sites on the Silk Road: Proceedings of an International Conference on Conservation of Grotto Sites," and these were symposium proceedings by one Neville Agnew. This was published in 1997, so it's a slightly older overview, but it still has a lot of important details. Mm-hmm. So in particular, concerning the Grand Buddha, he mentions that this sculpture benefited from multiple restorations over the years.
So we're not really seeing the original version of it now.
Right. That's something to keep in mind. So just going back to the earliest traces that he references in his article. So if you go back to the Qing Dynasty, that's 1636 through 1912. Documents indicate that the sculpture was heavily damaged at the time. So it had cavities in the face.
Kind of like the Sphinx or something?
Yeah, it was just, it had the upkeep had not prevented the face from kind of crumbling apart in places.
Uh-huh.
And then by the time you come to the Republic of China era, that's 1912 through 1949, photos show that it had been inaccurately restored. So they'd fixed. This is a problem where there are holes in the face, then you fix the face, and well, now the face looks a little different than it did before. Then by the 1960s, you have significant maintenance that's taking place. It's altering the nose, the eyes, the mouth, and the lower jaw of the Buddha. And Agnew argues that in light of all of this, it might perhaps be better not to restore the Buddha at all. Like if you're essentially, each time you're restoring it, you're kind of making it a little different. You're making it new each time. Mm-hmm. Like, are you actually preserving an ancient statue, or are you keeping up a modern statue that's sort of based on the base of something old?
Yeah, I think that's a common question in restoration, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always going to have deterioration. And is it better to allow things to deteriorate and let people see them in that state, or to falsely alter them to restore them?
Well,
which is more authentic?
Yeah, like for instance, in the West, the Parthenon is an example of this. So the Parthenon is severely damaged, but there's a history to that damage. And it's a fascinating history in terms of who has ownership at a given time, the violence that's been that has occurred there. Et cetera. We could get into the whole history in another podcast, but there is an ongoing discussion. Well, do you completely restore the Parthenon and then create this kind of new thing that is based on the old model and certainly an attempt to rebuild the old Parthenon, or do you maintain what's currently there and tell the story of how we got there?
My answer would be, anybody out there listening, if I can make the decision, you leave it how it is, but then you build a copy of it somewhere else. So like with the Parthenon, we've got the Parthenon in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, that's true, yes.
And I think that's not a bad approach. You know, you let it be as it is and let time take it and let's see what time has done to it. But then you do your best to create a model of what it would have been like in another place.
Now, I will point out that with the Grand Buddha, in the late 1990s, you did see an increased focus on the best ways to restore the Buddha, but do so in ways that were both scientifically and historically sound. So like, I'm essentially reaching the point where you realize, okay, what can we do that will, you know, maintain what we have, help protect it, restore areas that are damaged, but also be true to the history of the sculpture?
Mm-hmm.
So in 2001, according to Reuters News, there was actually a 250 million won or 33.6 million restoration project that took place at the Buddha. But by 2007, the nose had actually blackened again due to pollution.
Uh-huh.
And concerns over pollution actually prompted the local government to shut down factories and power plants close to the statue to help maintain it, which I think is a positive movement. Like people realizing, look, if we have to actually cut down on tackle the pollution problem if we want these artifacts to remain presentable.
I feel like that is not usually the solution you hear.
Yeah,
is shutting down heavy industry to protect heritage monuments or the environment.
Well, the Reuters article, touches on the fact that this was not an isolated problem. China was encountering this with numerous, sacred and important historical sites, various shrines, et cetera.
Right.
But hey, it's still there. It's still open, and it is a popular tourist destination. And based on what I was reading, you can spend a good half day there, looking at additional sites, temples, and the natural environment is supposedly really pleasant as well.
Yeah, if you see pictures of it, one of the things you'll notice is this tiny narrow staircase carved into the cliffside beside the Buddha, going up the side of it, so I guess people can get up higher to be near its face, one thing that's clear is how many people want to come see this beautiful work of art, but also they're so tiny.
Yes.
And they look so precarious when you see these long shots of the giant Buddha. Not that the Buddha would do this, but you can imagine it would just sort of like swing its hand up and like knock hundreds of people into the river.
Well, yeah, you can't help but think of that when you see a colossal stone titan in the likeness of a man. All right, we're going to take one more break, and we come back. We just have a few additional thoughts about, to a certain extent, the Grand Buddha, but also just this idea of remaking the Earth and then what happens when we do.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So I think one of the most compelling aspects of the Grand Buddha is that we see the mountain transformed into a human likeness. And in doing so, there are all of these ramifications to the natural environment. So there's the alleged alteration of the river, mm-hmm. the alteration of drainage on the mountain. And of course, these are just small and specific examples of what human beings have done just across the Anthropocene epoch. The idea that since the rise of agriculture, really, but certainly in the industrial age as well, we have just reshaped the earth. And in doing so, we have changed the natural environment.
That makes me wonder, I mean, how the Buddha plays into that metaphor. What do you think is the general, and you might not know the answer, but what do you think is the general environmental outlook of Buddhism? Is there a coherent one?
Well, I know for a fact, I think I might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but there was a wonderful New York Times article that came out in recent weeks about a resurgence of religious interest in China specifically. So it's people turning not just to Buddhism, but also Taoism and Confucianism, and in sort of reclaiming culturally important Chinese religious models, mm-hmm. they're also taking on environmental causes. So they are finding an environmental message in Buddhism, in Taoism, in Confucianism, and then becoming active with that within China and arguing for environmental protective measures.
It's hard not to see the Buddha as somehow more harmonious with nature in this depiction than something, say, like Mount Rushmore, because, as we mentioned, of the way the greenery tends to surround it, like green, maybe just moss and stuff like that is creeping into mm-hmm. some of the surfaces on the statue. But you can also just see these tree branches and the forest beyond trying to creep in and surround the Buddha. Like I don't know, like when you see the cartoon where Snow White is surrounded by chirping birds and things, it's like the very life of the forest itself is coming in to hug and honor the Buddha.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of something I guess it was the episode on biophilia where we talked about some of this. You know, I think you can, my read on it is that if you look to any major religion, I think you can find environmental trends within it, environmental messages within it. Mm-hmm. But as with any religion, it depends on who's handling it, right? Who's manipulating it in some cases, or who is delivering the message of it. And therefore, any faith can take a less environmental form.
Yeah, the dominion over the earth mentality versus the harmony with the earth mentality, or
right.
the preservation of the earth mentality.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible someone out there is making Buddhist arguments for the removal of environmental regulations, but I have not personally run across it. If you have run across it, listener, send it in, because I would love to have that added perspective. But in terms of just reshaping the earth, and it's worth pointing out that, yeah, all major powers have done it and continue to do it. So, you know, we can look to examples of reshaped mountains and dammed rivers here in the United States. But I also can't help but think of the Xi Ping Pu Dam, which is actually located in Sichuan province as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a large scale dam that some scientists have, you know, they've connected the dots here between its massive reshaping of the earth and some deadly earthquakes that have occurred in the region.
Really? I'm always curious about the extent to which people can actually trace human behavior to the causation of earthquakes. I'm not saying I never believe it happens, but I'm always curious, like, how much confidence can we really say that something we did caused an earthquake? You think scientists are pretty certain here?
Well, it's something we could definitely discuss in a later episode, like really break it apart. I mean, the scientists who are arguing that this is taking place. So what we're talking about here is
I'm sure they know better than I do. I don't mean to cast doubt on that.
Well, it's not a fringe science by any sense, but it is it's known as reservoir induced seismicity.
Okay.
Okay. So the idea is that you have rapid changes in water pressure caused by seasonal flood changes in reservoir levels. And this can activate already shaky ground and trigger an earthquake. So, for instance, the most famous example of this is the Three Gorges Dam in China.
Oh, yeah, the huge thing.
Yeah, so this is a massive – so you end up with a – well, of course, the way dams work, I think everybody's familiar with this. You dam a river and you end up with water on one side,
right.
A reservoir of water. And that's –
you control the flow.
Yeah, and that's a massive amount of water. That's a massive change – I mean, it's a change in mass. And so the idea with the Three Gorges here is that this reservoir ends up setting on two major fault lines, and that can actually affect seismic activity. So it's not a situation where you can't really say it alone is causing the earthquake, but it is influencing the factors that are at play in the causation of earthquakes.
Okay.
That's the argument. And,
well, tentatively, I believe it. I was speaking out of ignorance.
No. I mean, it's the kind of thing we could take apart in a later episode for sure. But in the case of the Xiaoping Pu Dam, this is a 315 million ton water reservoir, and it lies about 550 yards from a fault line and 3 miles from the epicenter of the Sichuan earthquake that killed at least reported 80,000 people in 2008. And that those stats are according to the Telegraph. Food for thought. Nobody's blaming this on the Buddha. Don't get me wrong, but naturally I don't want to argue that there's a 1-to-1 comparison to be made between carving a sculpture out of a mountain and creating a massive reservoir via the construction of a dam. But I think they both demonstrate this human ability and desire to remake the world, and then how we end up rediscovering the fragility of the world in the process and realizing that, yeah, when you change the shape of a mountain, that's going to have an impact. When you create this massive reservoir, it's going to have an impact. Because in the case of a massive reservoir created via a dam, you also have to count in pollution because you have water flowing into areas that were not previously submerged, and that might mean you are introducing existing pollutants into the water. You can have landslides, mudslides, weather changes. You have this what's called as the lake effect. So decreasing rainfall in the area around the reservoir, there's a decrease there, while there's an increase in rainfall in the surrounding mountain regions.
Hmm.
On top of that, you can have drought, you can have a species loss, and you can have the loss of historical relics as an area that was previously above water is now below water for the life of the dam.
Yeah, that's something I've rarely even considered as a consequence of damming rivers.
We actually have a HowStuffWorks.com article on the topic, so I'll have to link to that as well on the landing page for this episode at StuffToBlowYourMind.com. All right, so there you have it. A little introduction into, I think, one of the more remarkable statues in the world, one that I have not seen in person, but one day I would very much like to. Maybe I can convince Work to send me there.
I'm glad you brought this up, Robert. I didn't really know anything about this statue going in, and I think it's a fascinating work of art, and I too would like to see it one day.
So, how about you out there? Again, we'd love to hear from anyone who has actually ventured out and seen the Grand Buddha in person. What were your impressions? What do you think of the surrounding area? What do you think about other massive works of sculpture, be it a freestanding sculpture or something carved out of the side of a mountain? What kind of effect did it have on you?
I'm wondering what great works of art are going to be, you know, great, great sculptures that exist today or will exist soon are going to be visited by tourists in another 1200, 1300 years.
Hmm.
Like, what's the Grand Buddha that was built recently?
Huh.
Or I guess the Grand Buddha of the future, but not the Buddha of the future, not the Maitreya.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm being confusing. What's the sculpture out there today that people are going to be coming to with this much intensity more than 1,000 years from now?
Well, there are some very large statues in the United States that I don't think get a lot of press because they're just such recent constructions. I want to say there's a... It's a, so in Florida, there is a Pegasus battling a dragon, and it's, I want to say it's like the second or third largest statue in the United States, but it's not historic. It's a very recent creation, and it's just a dragon and a Pegasus. So I don't know. Maybe people will grow more attached to it, and it will become like a, something we're truly proud of, and we'll start putting it on money or something. But for the time being, I guess, you know, the Statue of Liberty, Mount Rushmore, these are still going to be the big attractions here in the United States until we build that 5,000-foot Nixon we've been talking about. So head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. You will find blog posts, videos, and links out to our social media accounts such as Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, you name it. Facebook is a great place to check us out, though, especially since we have a new discussion module group that is set up. And that's just a place where you can chime in with some longer form comments on recent episodes and stir up some discussion with other listeners and even your humble hosts here, you know, without it just being, you know, instantly lost in that Facebook timeline.
Yeah, so if you're interested, request to join. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, you can do it the old-fashioned way and email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.